Okay, so I'm Reiner, and I've met all of you, but I'm trained as an artist, and I also do educational work, although I'm becoming much more of a small-time bureaucrat. I run a program that provides services to kindergarten through fifth grade most of the time. And summer's a particular busy time because we have expanded programming, and we get to be with a large number of children 8 hours a day.
Thank you for joining us.
As compared to the usual 5 hours a day. Makes a big difference. So this is occurring within my 2 weeks of vacation time I had requested a while ago, and I really need that vacation time. But it's been really interesting. It's been a very different sort of vacation. We're going on a camping road trip when we leave tomorrow. Heading probably towards northeastern Oregon. But it's been really fascinating to be here. So I'm active in the Jewish community, and the parts of that community I'm most connected with are a group called Kadima, Kadima Reconstructionist Community. Reconstructionist Judaism is one of the streams of Judaism. And Congregation Beth Shalom, which is a conservative congregation, where I've done some major art projects and submit the third bit and still have lots of connections. And I was raised in a radical secular home, but a very Jewish home. And I mention that because as an artist and as someone with my particular mix of affiliations and backgrounds, and also someone who's been a political activist in various ways, including way too much time spent on the Israeli-Palestinian circumstance and how to resolve that, I tend to see things coming from a variety of perspectives and strategies and techniques, and really believe in integrating those. And so I'm not what in my mind I was stereotyped as a traditional commentator. However, within Jewish commentary and taking off on what was talked about in the last hour next door, what is his name again?
Fred Niedermeyer.
Niedner.
The way, the idea of Midrash gives such opportunity to weave a variety of sources together.
Yeah.
I would add to his definition of Midrash that from the Jewish perspective, Midrash is oral Torah.
Mm-hmm. It's oral Torah.
Oral Torah. And that there are two Torahs that were given, metaphorically speaking, at Mount Sinai, the written Torah and the oral Torah. And I'm being really simplistic here, but the oral Torah represents all the commentary that has happened on the Torah.
Mm-hmm. Oh wow.
And Midrash is filling in the gaps in the written Torah in many ways. The term gets used very broadly, but that's one thing I think in multi-faith setting it's really important to put out, because it represents a strategy that is very particular. Yeah.
What percentage of Midrash, Reiner, do you think has been written down? Because it sounds like some Midrash has not been.
I have no idea.
And maybe nobody does.
The high point of Midrash occurred probably between about, well, a little bit before the year 1 C Common Era and the year 300 Common Era.
Interesting.
During the period right before the destruction of the temple, of the second temple, and then the period of a strong Jewish community in Babylon. And one of the things about Midrash and the Talmud, which is one of the places where there's a great deal of Midrash, is that in a sense those things are homeland in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. It's a portable intellectual storytelling homeland that people have taken with them through the centuries. Mm-hmm. And that's one way to understand how diaspora has functioned. And that then there's additional, Midrash continues to be created. It continued to be created. Mm-hmm. And as part of the explication of scripture and turning scripture over and over, and and sometimes pops up in surprising places in legalistic perspectives, and it continues to be done. And we're going to be looking at some very old Midrash and some very modern Midrash. And Midrash really represents, it was interesting, Fred describing how it's necessary sometimes to be in an adversarial relationship with God.
Yeah.
And oftentimes Midrash expresses that, expresses people's struggling with scripture. Mm-hmm. And an example, a very basic example of Midrash that does that is that when the Egyptian army pursuing the Israelites leaving oppression in Egypt was drowned in the Sea of Reeds, that the angels in heaven rejoiced and God rebuked them, saying that, why are you rejoicing? The Egyptians are my creation as well. You should be grieving. Mm-hmm. So clearly some thinker had a really hard time with that story.
Yeah.
And sure. And you know, so there's a spectrum within Jewish thought of mitigation, I guess I'll call it, of text. You know, things like that, things like how eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth is interpreted as really as recipe for restitution. If you harm somebody, what value have you taken from their life? And how do you make restitution for that? How do you do reparations and such? So there, it's a very complex and exciting thing. And I think the major traditions all have their own form of that. But someone from a Jewish perspective, I find it really exciting what that part of our heritage. We talked about Midrash a little bit. And I'll just say that the Torah is the five books of Moses. Torah sometimes is used very broadly for any kind of conversation about scriptures, but Torah comes from the same root as the word moreh or mora, so that means teacher. So really, one way to translate Torah is the teaching. And when people are going to do a drash, an explication of Torah, they're usually described as giving a devar Torah, a word of Torah. Mm-hmm. And then devar means both word and thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, words can be very concrete. This is a devar. This is a devar. And one of the fun things that's going on now is that people understand that you can do shared divrei Torah, words of Torah, not just with writing and talking, but with dance and music and visual art.
Yes.
Just a little bit of context.
Can poetry be considered Midrash?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And we're going to look at some poetry.
Okay.
And Akidah means the binding. The story of the Akidah is read twice during the Jewish year. It's read in its logical place within the cycle of Torah readings. You know, every week is a different Torah portion. And it's also read on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. The first, so outside of Israel, the holiday, certain holidays are celebrated for 2 days, and sort of an insurance policy for when people are spread out over the place, just kind of really trying to figure out the calendar, which is the lunar calendar. And, you know, and just in case people got confused. Still, we're going to perform the deed of observing the holiday. But anyway, on Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year, and it's the beginning of the cycle of intense reflection and turning yourself around, working to turn yourself around and make atonement for mistakes you've made and try to direct yourself back on the right path. Because in Hebrew, the word chet, which is usually translated as sin, actually comes from archery idea. That when you commit a chet, you're missing the mark, you're missing the target. Which in many ways is a lot, I find that frankly a more comfortable idea than how we hear the word sin in English.
Yeah.
But in any case, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, when this dysfunctional and disturbing family drama is read, that's the story of finding out that of Ishmael being born, Isaac being born, and then how Ishmael and Hagar are sent out into the wilderness. And then that concludes, with a voice saying that here's your well of water, and here, and you will be the ancestor of a great people. And then on the second day, the story is read.
Uh-huh. It just struck me, okay, for the roots for Hagar, does that have anything to do, thinking about Gar, meaning stranger, does her name encompass stranger?
That's a good question. I think it is more or less spelled the same way. She is Egyptian.
Right.
And Hagar means the stranger. And it's essentially someone who has kind of the green card status. By the way, just also talking about, you know, a little bit more about the idea of how Midrash functions. Midrash tells us that later on, after Sarah dies, Abraham has been forced to send Hagar away. Later on, when Sarah dies, eventually Abraham marries someone again named Keturah. And the Midrash says that's Hagar.
That's the same woman?
Yeah, that they reconnect.
Oh, wow.
I like that.
Why does she have a different name? Okay, I don't know. Okay.
What I think is interesting is how those women in those first two generations pull the strings and make the law.
Oh, yeah. It's often the women who determine what happens.
Exactly. I mean, that Sarah,
and the men kind
she
of,
suddenly blames him. You know, it's your fault. Well, who's the one who invited Hagar to get pregnant? Sarah. And then she gets ticked off about it. And Rebecca the same.
So, why don't we, what I'd like to do is to, let me double check. You know what? I'm going to end up with a couple of different
You have the artistic freedom
here.
To do anything you want.
Yeah, I've got a lot of power right now. Okay, I had a crazy week before coming here, and I kind of grabbed two different things, and I mean, they're kind of similar, but I think what I'm going to do is we'll go with the PowerPoint, but we'll bounce back and forth a little bit.
Okay.
And I just love these clickers. So, let's make it so we can see this. So our objectives are to identify compelling Jewish universal issues, to look at how the text reveals and conceals critical elements, to understand how symbols are displayed in the narrative and how art of the Akedah, the binding, can be both narrative and symbolic, to show how the difficulty of the text continually creates midrash that's relevant to our immediate experience, and to see how this has been a compelling subject for artists and how people have responded. And then we hopefully will do some hands-on stuff later. A linguistic digression. I've spoken about how Hebrew always works with a basic root that's called a shoresh, and that was referred to in the Bible study that occurred earlier. So there's a particular root that is Aleph Mem Nun. You can basically look at it as kind of A. Aleph is a silent letter, but let's call it kind of A, M, N. And these are all words that come from that same root that are relevant to what we're going to be doing and to the practice of being an artist. So Amen, and these all come from the same root. Amen literally means so be it. Emunah is faith or belief. And Aman is one way to say artist or craftsman. Amanut is art. Imein is to train or to teach. And Hittamein is to practice or train oneself. And so that connection between creativity and craft and faith or belief is really intriguing. And faith, I don't think faith or belief necessarily means that you're being subservient. But having some fundamental, it was Paul Tillich, I believe, who defined faith as that existential question about what it meant to be and how to deal with that. In Jewish tradition, there's the idea of hidur mitzvah, which means to make the act, the commandment, beautiful. And it brings up the question of what it means to make something beautiful. And not necessarily pretty. This is the comic or graphic artist Robert Crumb produce a graphic novel version of Genesis, and I think what Robert Alter here is basically saying is what I've highlighted there: all paintings isolate particular moments in the narrative for representation. They don't portray the whole tale, but only that part of the tale that has for some reason engaged them. And they don't tell, they show. And the dilemma that we come up with, if we're showing a representation of a character or event, how we try to specify that. It creates an interesting challenge of a foreclosure of ambiguity. I'm not sure I totally agree with this, but it does throw down a challenge.
Well, it challenges kind of the whole play of part to whole, this iconic play that is hard to do. And sometimes we don't have time enough to do it, so we have that foreclosed representation.
Yes, and also in our society, we are really encouraged to look at the art in and of itself rather than art in relationship to the whole experience of the artist and the context in which it was created. Mm-hmm. especially interestingly enough, with the fact that we can share images freely now.
Yeah.
And the value of an art becomes directly connected to the value of that image, and sometimes literally the monetary value of the art. If you've ever gone to museums and seen people, hordes of people in front of something like the Mona Lisa, mm-hmm. while ignoring the art around it, for example. But I also think that this is challenging because Robert Alter is not a painter.
No.
And he's responding to a narrative created by a visual artist. So he's throwing, that's why I put this as throwing down the gauntlet. This is a very provocative statement.
Is that his latest book?
Robert Crumb, I'm not sure.
Okay. Or Robert Alter, yeah. Because I know he had a recent book, but I don't know if it's this one. And I think he died recently, too.
Yeah, he did.
Crumb did?
No, Alter. He's okay. A biblical theologian.
Alter's a reviewer, right?
No, Crumb is.
Actually, it was another well-known graphic artist who died recently.
Oh.
But yeah, I think he... So the begins of a response to what Alter's saying. Marks on paper with or without recognizable images can be read like a language and can reveal to the person making the marks as well as to the viewer what's been going on in the mind of the mark maker. Marks on paper represent pure expression, devoid of any realistic or symbolic images, and can reveal thoughts of which even the thinker is unaware. Again, I'm not presenting these as, I'll say it's gospel, but as different approaches to the challenge of engaging with art. But indeed the act of making a mark and the character of marks can bring up surprising messages. And then can someone read what Paul Cézanne wrote?
A minute in the world's life passes. To paint it in its reality and forget everything for that, to become that minute, to be the sensitive plate, give the image of what we see, forgetting everything that has appeared before our time.
So when we're making art, one critical aspect of it is learning to see, learning to observe. And in order to really observe, you have to have some kind of empathy with that which you are observing or purveying. And so that can create a very specific kind of focus. So that's just a little bit about some approaches to art making. And with any of this process, there's the grain of sand that creates the pearl. Now, I'm going to cheat right here. We're not going to read the source text. It sounds like I have a feeling that you're all pretty familiar with the story. So, but we're going to dive into breaking down the source text a bit. And one of the things about working with scripture, certainly in the book of Genesis, is the terseness that occurs, the repetitions, what's left out, and the question of universality. And also how language works. So Hebrew can really work with homonyms and puns. And in this particular story, these are two very important, sounds like homonymic, terms. Yireh is seen or vision. Ro'eh or ro'ah is to see in Hebrew. And so Isaac asks, where's the lamb for the offering? And Abraham gives this very helpful reply. Adonai yireh. God will see or provide. And then at the end of our story, Abraham names that place Adonai Yireh, therefore the present saying that on the mountain of God there is vision. And then there's yare, fear or awe. Yira shamayim is literally awe of the heavens. And that's something that pops up in the liturgy a lot. And the angel says, the angel that intervenes in the story says, now I know that Yirei Elohim, you are God-fearing or God-awing, since you have not withheld your son.
That's an interesting wordplay when I think about, like, part of the covenant that God makes with, well, all the different covenants assume that there is the witness of creation, so creation also sees. So when you were talking about mountain of God, there is vision. There's just compounded who sees, including the cosmos.
Mm-hmm. And in these stories, in the general context of these stories, there's a lot of time travel. So the tradition tells us that everybody was at Mount Sinai. Everybody. Mm-hmm. It was there. Past, present, and future. So there are parallels and reverses in the story. Earlier, when Abraham is leaving his father's home, he's told to lechacha, go forth from your land, from your next of kin, from your father's house, to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation. So there's this rhythm to it. Go forth from your land, from your next of kin, from your father's house, to the land, etc. And then, but it's interesting, lechacha means you go. But there's one little difference. And, you know, there's the same rhythm, a very similar rhythm to when God is speaking to Abraham about taking his son. And it starts with kach na. Na means please. God is asking, take please your son. You're special, you're only one. So go forth, take please. From your land, your special only one, from your next of kin, the one you love, from your father's house, Isaac. And then it says once again, and lech lecha, go forth to the land of Moriah and offer him up there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, I will tell you. And so there's these curious reverses. I will make of you a great nation. And theoretically, I will not make you a great nation. And parallels to the land of Moriah, the land I will show you. And there are, again, interesting pairings in this section of the story. So Abraham goes up to the place where he sees God, and Hagar is down in the lowest possible place when the well saves lives. There's the powerful images in the story. There's the mountain, by the way, and the place, by the way, one of the Hebrew names for God is Hamakom, the place.
Does that place then get mutated into, like, I can think of rock or broad place or Is that part of the whole?
Well, rock is also another term.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there's bunches and bunches of terms, because if God has no name that's pronounceable
right. In
the tradition, people need something.
Right.
So the compassionate, the rock, the place, there's many, many names. You know, putting the wood for the offering on Isaac. Isaac carries the wood. Isaac is the assistant in his own destiny. And then Abraham takes in his hand the fire and the knife. And there's again a pun here, because the knife is, the word that's used for it is ma'achelet. And ma sounds like what? Ma means what? In regular Hebrew. And achelet sounds like to eat. So the word that's used for knife in the Torah sounds like what eats, what devours. Mm-hmm. Huh. Which is very spooky, yes. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense of the rhythm of purposeful repetition. And there's artful omission and absence of detail at the same time. And then I'll add that there's other bits of detail. So now I want to go back to this, because I really should have. Worked with this much. So I want to look at some midrash. So do I have a volunteer to read number one?
When God commanded Abraham, take your son, Abraham did not set out immediately. He asked, which son? God answered, your favorite one. Then Abraham said, but I have two sons, Ishmael and Isaac, and one is favored by his mother, and the other is favored by his mother. So God answered, take the one whom you love. And Abraham replied, I love them both, so how can I choose? Finally, God told him, take Isaac.
So we have this pattern, take your son. I have two sons. Each is an only son to his mother, whom he loved. I love him both. And then finally, that voice from heaven, Isaac. Shall we go around? Let's go to the right.
So you want number two?
Mm-hmm.
At that moment, Isaac agreed with his mouth. But in his heart he said, who will save me from my father? I have no salvation other than the Holy One, blessed be he. As it is written, my help is from God who made heaven and earth. Psalm 121. One of the pictures I always told my kids, my students, on this was, Isaac was not a tiny child. And so I said to my high school students is who I got to teach, I said, you're 17, could you wrestle your dad? Well, yeah, I could push him away. I said, but what did Isaac do? He didn't. He did what his dad told him. The sons in there just went, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
And there are different versions of Isaac's response.
Yes.
You know, we just read one of them, the realization, can I trust my father?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can only place hope in what? In destiny, really, and in my sense of faith that things will work out. So there's a lot of pairings in this. There's the preparation, the catharsis in the story. There's illumination and readiness. Freeing and severance, surrender and healing, test and growth, and innocence and knowledge. There's so many of these pairings that occur.
And I think, too, that as I kept hearing it being taught and wrestled with it, it's always, and even in Hebrews, and it says, and Abraham, you know, who was the faithful one. And I'm thinking Isaac got shortchanged in this. He was faithful also. He didn't run away. And that's...
But in many versions of the story, that faithfulness comes at a cost. And there was discussion earlier about the story of Jacob and Esau.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions is, why did Isaac allow this to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interpretations is that Isaac was damaged.
From that time?
Isaac had PTSD.
Yeah.
That this experience left Isaac lacking in something.
Okay.
I mean, Isaac... Which was presumably a good partner. He tried to be a good partner, Rebecca. Rebecca and Isaac are pretty specifically identified as being one of the first love stories in the Bible. And, you know, when they encounter each other, it's love at first sight.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, Rebecca falls off her camel
right.
when she sees right. Isaac. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow.
Well, and it's interesting because when you, the surrender and the healing, when I think about rupture in relationships, you know, from a pastoral care perspective, you try to have the two partners who have this estrangement or severance to in some way repair, right? That's what we do as parents with our children and stuff. But so this is what's kind of sad for me is that perhaps Isaac does find healing and some sort of repair, but not with his father, but it comes through Rachel. So he has some, but it's not with the original broken trust with his father. So mm-hmm. that's troubling and feels so real.
And then, of course, there's where's the mother in this?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And one very specific interpretation is that Sarah sees this going away, you know, sees these two people going away. And then there's no mention of Sarah.
Right.
And then Sarah has died. it was put out that Sarah learns what's going on and she dies from grief.
Yeah. Broken heart.
That she lets out a great cry and dies.
And that's another ruptured relationship
yeah.
between
yes.
her and her husband.
So, and along with this is that this is one of the first places in the Torah where the word love is used. When, you know, we just read that when Abraham is told to take his son, his only son, the one he loves. Isn't that interesting?
What's that the Hebrew word for that kind of love?
Ahava.
Ahav. Okay. And
yeah,
is that the primary Hebrew word throughout Old Testament, throughout all the text?
That's a good question. It is the primary.
Okay,
the primary
that
word
definition.
That gets used for love. It doesn't get used very much.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of ideas about how old Isaac was. That he is perhaps 13 or he's perhaps in his 30s. A child or an adult. Where did Isaac end up at the end of the story? That's a mystery. And there are various... ideas about this. One is that he was swooped away and he kind of went to yeshiva. He went to an advanced studies program. In a medieval legend, at a time when Jewish communities were in great danger, there are some stories that either he actually was killed and then was resurrected, or that the angel swooped him up and took him away to a safe place from which he eventually was returned. I mean, that's kind of parallel to the graduate school idea. And then there's a question about the whole issue about generational trust.
Generational what?
Trust.
Oh, trust, okay, yeah.
Teshuvah, is that New Year?
Teshuvah means to turn.
Oh, to turn.
It's the Hebrew word that's often translated as repentance, but it literally means to turn, or to turn yourself.
Okay.
In the direction of good behavior.
And that is at Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah, the period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Or even a little bit longer through the holiday of Sukkot. Because it starts with Rosh Hashanah, the new year, and then there's what are called the 10 days of awe between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And then, if people haven't quite worked it out, we're told, you know, there's still time going into Sukkot.
Those are the 10 days you're supposed to make amends and repair and.
That, you know, you're supposed to go around to the people you've wronged and try to make teshuvah. And there's a very specific, Maimonides like to make lists and have different levels of things.
Oh.
And he has the different levels of teshuvah.
I see.
Of stating what you have done, apologizing for it, taking accountability for it, and making a commitment not to do your best, not to do that again, not to repeat it. We need a lot of teshuvah out there in public life right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do.
So, you know, questions that come up. What is Abraham as a father? What did Isaac really know? What's the role of the ram? Where is Sarah, as we've already talked about? Are there echoes in other traditions of the story? I know that it's clear that they're both Muslims and Christians. This story is a powerful story. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that for many Christians, you know, the, I suppose, near sacrifice of Isaac has parallels with the story of Jesus. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's always, there are some Christian denominations that really cherry pick the Old Testament and will say, like, even Genesis 3:15, I will put enmity between these, that's a Christ figure. That's one of the ways I was taught. And the ram, well, of course, he was the Lamb of God. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, please.
And then we heard those of you who were, you know, I guess almost everybody was at Vespers last night when Adam told the story of Abraham and Ishmael. Mm-hmm. And the Akedah in Muslim tradition. By the way, coming up is Eid al-Adha,
which is
and Akedah Adha.
Yeah.
They come from the same root, but that's the Muslim holiday that is about this story.
Oh,
my Muslim friends in Hong Kong, we had several Muslim friends, and the one friend just said to me, "You backed the wrong son."
You backed the wrong son.
Yes, but remember that midrash that we just looked at. But I have two sons.
Yep, exactly. When I read that, I thought.
And I love them both.
And you know that I only, you know, I'm an only child and I have an only child.
Oh.
So I haven't dealt with sibling dynamics. Do you all have siblings?
Two sons.
I do.
We have two sons and I have three brothers.
Or you have And some
I was
of you
the
have,
best in our family.
And some of you have more than one child.
Yep, two sons.
You do. So, yeah, I can only guess at some of the things that you needed to work out.
Well, we see it with our grandchildren who are here this week. You know, they're 8 and 11, and of course there's, I think rivalry might be too strong a word, but.
It's differentiation.
Yeah.
I'm a twin, and just that whole struggle to wrestle to be
girl or boy,
identical twin sister.
Okay.
Yeah.
And for those about, you know, for parents of more than one child, what happens? You know, how does favoritism work?
Mm-hmm.
And and especially in the dynamic of having to exert your authority and try to point the child in a good direction.
And I still, go on.
Well, there's a cost and a promise to, like, the favoritism versus everything's fair and equal, because if you're a favorite, you're seen mm-hmm. as particular, unique, special, you're seen for who you are. And if everything is fair and equal, then you're seen as not being an individual, but as mm-hmm. the same, mm-hmm. when in fact that's not true. So I think there's cost and promises to both positions of how you are perceived.
That's interesting, because that plugs into a discussion that's very happening a lot right now, the difference between equality and equity.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
And I'm sure you've seen the cartoon of Equality, where, you know, it shows the different heights, you know, the fence, yeah. trying to see, look over the fence. Yeah.
In my family, I got the idea that the favorite also was the one that more was expected of. Mm-hmm. And I felt like early on I was the favorite because I was the eldest. Mm. Like one of my responsibilities was to look out for my younger brother, who was 3 years younger, and later my other brother, who was 10 years younger. And so, I don't know, there was more responsibility. I don't know, it's hard to say if one of us was favored. I think it
has to do with the wives, or the mothers.
The mother?
Yeah. I think that, again, Sarah was the old lady, and Hagar was the young beauty, is how, in mm-hmm. my heart,
oh,
picture
actually,
that.
Yeah. And Sarah was so old, she didn't think she could have kids.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so then she says, go on ahead, that's all right. But I really like this, number one, what Rabbi Eliezer is saying, you know, that I have these two, and which one?
Yeah.
And how much of that had to do with who he loved at different times because of Sarah or because of Hagar?
Yeah.
There are also the power dynamics at work with these children,
yes.
because among other things, the way what happens earlier in this tale is that there are no children.
Yes.
And Sarah tells Abraham, go be with Hagar.
Exactly.
And of course, in the power thing, Hagar is the subservient, the less powerful woman.
Right.
And Sarah is implying that a child who would be born of that would in a sense belong to her.
Exactly.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
She's my maid.
Because Hagar belonged to her.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And but of course that doesn't exactly work out.
Yeah.
No.
And then many of the statements that are made about Ishmael line up quite well with the statements we make about the other, that they're wild, that they're unruly,
yes.
that they can't control themselves.
Particularly the end, where the blessing is given, but yet,
yes,
you will be of the goats.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
This is the second Lois in
yes.
the group.
There's another Lois.
This is
I'm
Lois.
A Lois.
Oh, how nice to meet. We'll have to have lunch together.
Oh, there's two Loises.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you're
very
surrounded.
Very rare. Very rare.
Does
yes.
that make you Superman, since you're between
yeah,
two
right.
Loises?
Mm-hmm. Makes me Timothy.
No. Exactly. And
no.
I'm the old granny, huh?
No, I'm the granny.
We both are.
So to dive back into some of these parallels and some of the more disturbing aspects of the story. In the medieval legend, in the medieval legends that were created during the time of the Crusades, because what happened in Jewish communities in Europe during the Crusades is on the way to the Middle East, the Crusaders who were going to fight the infidel would go after what they viewed as the infidel right there. And it was a terrible, terrible time for Jewish communities. And this is when the idea of Kiddush Hashem was revived. Kiddush Hashem means sanctification of the name. Mm. And it means, and it is, it's applied to die as a martyr. And so, and this was a period when in many Jewish communities, people were dying as martyrs, that they were perceived as dying as martyrs. And that comes into what they were thinking and writing, where they identify with Isaac. Mm. And where there are some things about Isaac, you know, like I said, about Isaac actually being killed and then being resurrected. And then there's some very disturbing things that we're going to read now from Kierkegaard and from the Book of Maccabees that I think these are hard things, but they reflect a more, another perspective than what I'll call the warmer perspective that we've been bringing into things. Who would like, who can read number three, Kierkegaard?
I could. Isaac embraces Abraham's knees, pleads for his young life, for the fair hope of his future. Then for an instant he turned away from him, and when Isaac again saw Abraham's face, his glance was wild, his form was horror. He seized Isaac by the throat, threw him to the ground, and said, "Stupid boy, dost thou suppose that I am your father? I am an idolater. Dost thou suppose that this is God's bidding? No, it is my desire." Then Isaac trembled and cried out in his terror, "O God in heaven, have compassion on me. God of Abraham, have compassion on me. If I have no father upon earth, be thou my father." But Abraham, in a low voice, said to himself, "O Lord in heaven, I thank thee. After all, it is better for him to think me a monster than to lose faith in thee."
Oh, wow.
That's from Fear and Trembling by Soren Kierkegaard.
There you go, Soren.
Wow.
So don't blame God, blame me.
So in a certain sense, Abraham is moving, according to Kierkegaard, moving in the direction of being a martyr himself.
Yeah. And in between, I will step.
Yeah, the go between.
Yeah, I will step between you and God. Well, the beginning is horrible, but then it ends good. Of the phrase.
Yeah.
Oh, stupid boy.
Kierkegaard is a very interesting.
Yes.
Theologian philosopher, yes. Isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I'm not saying much about it, but you obviously have a lot of responses. And then, can you read number four? So this is from Maccabees, and think about what was going on at this when in the mm-hmm. period that Maccabees works with in terms of, well, the wars.
Yeah.
It's what we would call an intertestamental period.
Yes.
There's lots of uprisings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And different countries are taking over Israel.
And the Maccabees, you know, the Maccabees, the people who became the Hasmonean dynasty, initially were the leaders in the struggle against the domination of the Hellenistic Empire and Hellenistic thinking. Which is one of the sources of the word for heretic in Hebrew, which is apikoros. And I forget who I had this conversation with, but can anybody guess what apikoros comes from? It's from the Greek, so.
It's from Greek?
Yeah, so what do you think it refers to?
Apocrypha.
No? What it sounds like. I'll give you a clue, a philosopher.
Socrates?
No. It sounds like it, like the person's name. Epicurus. So Epicurus was the hedonistic thinker.
Yeah, was the guy that invented those brownie bars.
Now, however, it's interesting because, we tend to think of, in modern terms, we think of hedonism as someone who just really enjoys pleasure and revels in pleasure, right? But actually, Epicurus had more of a Zen approach. What he was teaching was to really appreciate the value of the mundane, of the daily life, and to really have a certain kind of focus. And as such, must have been really quite seductive. Think about how many people on some in a very deep way and some in a very shallow way respond to Zen Buddhism. And I can imagine that there are some people from other traditions, some leaders who were probably rather disturbed about the possibility of their children getting involved in Zen Buddhism, something from a very different tradition that is very attractive because of how it, the kind of moderation and appreciation of the daily and the sense of focus. So anyway, that's just kind of a footnote.
Yeah,
but that has stuck in Hebrew. I mean, my wife is an apikoros. My atheist wife who lights candles every Friday night and so on. But contextually, this is from Book of the Maccabees and it does have a historical context. So go ahead.
Remember that it is because of God that you have a share in the world and have enjoyed life. For this reason, you are bound to endure any hardship for the sake of God. For his sake also was our father Abraham zealous to immolate his son Isaac, the father of a nation. Nor did Isaac flinch when he saw his father's hand, armed with a sword, descending upon him.
So there have been various periods in the history of words like this that have emphasized, where there has been really a more fundamentalist approach, a more, in a sense, violent approach to what it meant to have faith. And this is written in a period where there had been a lot of suffering and a lot of, the wars of the Maccabees. And there are stories about Hannah and her sons. And she gives up each one of her sons to the executioner. And this is also right before the period of the Roman oppression. And in the Yom Kippur liturgy, there is the martyrology where it describes in terrible detail the death of the prominent rabbis of the period at the hands of the Romans. So again, contextuality really counts in how people have responded to this story. One of the martyrs that I just mentioned is Rabbi Akiva. There's this very short statement from him. Everything is known in advance, but the option is yours.
Agency.
Interesting about how free will works. And Rabbi Akiva has a very profound statement following what I just read. Number 6, can you read that, Lois?
The king, God, has 4 sons.
Yes.
Is that what we're reading? One is beaten and remains silent. One is beaten and kicks back. Sounds like children, doesn't it? One is beaten and pleads for mercy. One is beaten and says, hit me again. Abraham is the one who is beaten and remains silent. As it is written, take your son, Isaac, and offer him up as a burnt offering. He should have spoken up in protest, saying, yesterday you said to me through Isaac, will you see me called?
Get it straight. What do you want? You want a nation or do you want nothing?
Yeah, and isn't it interesting how, just in the conversations that have been going on, for example, what Fred... Yeah. Those of you who heard what Fred was talking about, here's Rabbi Akiva saying this. And did Rabbi Akiva study human psychology? Fundamental human psychology?
Apparently.
He must have.
And this sounds like it's straight out of a textbook about responding to the statement those of us who work in education with kids often refer to, that for every behavior there's a reason.
Yep.
And of course, the whole conversation about how trauma functions and how trauma gets passed onwards. And this Rabbi Akiva, one historical note that I think it's important to just mention in a Christian context, in a place like Camp Holden, is that in the Jewish context, the Pharisees are actually the ancestors of rabbinic, are the creators of rabbinic Judaism. And from our perspective, Jesus fits precisely into the Pharisaic tradition. And so it's rather logical that Jesus would be arguing with himself, in a sense,
yes,
with his own roots, with his own people.
With himself.
Yes. Yeah.
And so does St. Paul.
Yeah. Well, St. Paul also fits. Well, no, I'm not trying to analyze this because that's not my tradition. But in any case, Akiva is Akiva, Hillel, Shammai, various other rabbis of the spirit, Hanina.
And what is
they fit into the Pharisaic tradition, which tended to be more democratic, more decentralized, more. It was the beginning of the idea of the function of rabbis, the function of the synagogue, and the Sadducees were the priestly class, their aristocracy. They tended to be more fundamentalist in a lot of ways, and of course were affiliated with the temple cult.
And so they were kind of colluding with, like, for example, the Hasmonean dynasty. I mean, they were in cahoots with, they had power and privilege over.
You're talking about the Sadducees.
And with the Maccabees, one of the reasons why Hanukkah is celebrated in the way it is celebrated, the emphasis on the miracle as compared to the militarism,
right,
is the rabbis being persecuted. That comes out of the rabbis being persecuted as essentially agents of, in a sense of decentralization of the working class. The Hasmoneans became a tyrannical dynasty. And so the rabbis shifted the emphasis of the holiday away from, they made the decision that we would do, it was not by might, not by power,
not
but by
power.
Spirit alone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is the period of Akiva and all those?
Akiva is in the period, I don't remember exactly, but between about 1 and 100, it's before the temple is destroyed
in
70 CE.
Yeah, right.
So between 1 and 70
okay.
CE. And Akiva, a lot of these rabbis actually were working class people. Akiva didn't become a rabbi until he was in his 40s. And I think he was a carpenter or a shoemaker.
Did he live in Jerusalem? Was this primarily where the rabbinic community continued?
I think
Akiva
may have been from the Galilee. I'm not
so
quite sure.
Safed? So from the village of Safed?
I don't remember what it said his origins were. Anyway, lots of contextualization here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've talked about these things. Okay, so I think we've seen how depending on the context of the people who were writing these things, who were creating these interpretations, very basically we've seen how that really shapes the perspective. And before we look at this, I want to read number nine, which is a poem by the modern Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai, who I really recommend reading. Amichai died, I think, about 3 years ago. And why don't we do this stanza by stanza, or verse by verse?
Bob,
you want
to go first?
Sure. The real hero of the Isaac story was the ram, who didn't know about the conspiracy between the others, as if he had volunteered to die instead of Isaac. I want to sing a song in his memory about his curly wool and his human eyes, about the horns that were so silent on his living head, and how they made those horns into shofars when he was slaughtered, to sound their battle cries or to blare out their obscene joy.
I want to remember the last frame, like a photo. In an elegant fashion magazine, the young man tanned, manicured in his jazzy suit, and beside him, the angel, dressed for a party in a long silk gown, both of them empty-eyed, looking at two empty places.
And behind them, like a colored backdrop, the ram caught in the thicket before the slaughter. The thicket was his last friend.
The angel went home. Isaac went home. Abraham and God had gone long before. But the real hero of the Isaac story was the ram.
That's a great piece.
Thank you for putting that there.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? I really encourage you to look for this writer, this poet. And he writes actually other poems about this as well. Well, he just was a really prolific poet. You know, when we talk about on the mountain of God, the mountain of holiness, there is vision, you know, and we can connect with that with the idea when you teach somebody to draw, you're teaching them how to see. And there's so many things that the story tells us about awareness and vision and seeing. I understand that there's a bias here because from my point of view, I'm a very visual person. I don't have good eyesight, but I use my eyes. And one interpretation is that in a sense, there are rams everywhere if we could only see them. There is another midrash that is written in a more lighthearted way, another modern midrash. I really need to remember who wrote this because I read it long ago in a Jewish magazine, a wonderful Jewish magazine that exists for a while called Genesis 2. But basically the midrash is that a ram is grazing in a pasture and a voice says, "Ram, ram." And the ram says, "Hineni, here I am." And the voice says, "I want you to go up to that mountaintop, that hilltop. There's a man there. There are two humans. There's a man and a boy. And the man is about to kill the boy. And I want you to substitute yourself to not allow that boy to be killed." And the ram says, "Excuse me, those are humans. Why should I do anything for humans?" And the voice says, "Please, I really need you to do this. If you don't do this, the world will be changed in a way that can't happen." And the ram says, "I see. Well, I am a ram. I understand that life has its difficulties and its impermanence. We are eaten by other creatures, by lions and certainly by those people. But listen, I need something from you." And of course, the ram is arguing with God. And the ram proceeds to win every single thing in Jewish law that has to do with kindness for animals. And then in the end, the ram says, "But do they have to eat us?" And God says, "I'm sorry, they don't know enough to be vegetarian." They, you know, I really hope that these people who are part of my creation, just like you, will evolve to the point. Because that is the goal, that they will evolve to the point that they will not have to eat any other living creature. But they're not there yet. And the ram finally exerts the last promise, which you can, you know, one can take with a grain of salt in this particular midrash, but that if they have to eat us, they will kill us with as least the least amount of pain possible. And in the laws of kashrut, of keeping kosher, you're supposed to kill the animal with one swift cut, instantaneously. If there's one imperfection on the blade of the slaughterer's knife, it's not kosher. And so that's the final thing the ram wins. And so, and it's interesting because it, you know, the way the ram is told in that midrash, they're portrayed in that modern midrash and the modern midrash by Amichai, it's playing with the story in a really interesting way. And what if Isaac had had the capacity to bargain like that? Mm-hmm. But Isaac, you know, in the story itself, is silent in the midrash, and whether it's, you know, obviously Isaac has more of a voice.
Can I ask a very basic story or a question about the story? Because I've always had a difficulty with the story that God would even ask that a child be sacrificed. So one of the person, somebody, or I read it in a commentary, said, well, the story was to show that the God of Abraham was different than the gods that demanded child sacrifice, in that God pulled back at the last moment. And so it was a test. And I'm thinking, it just does not make sense to me. So from a Jewish perspective, how do you wrestle that out, that God would even ask?
I don't have any particular ready answers for that. It would be interesting to see what Rabbi Yohanan would say about it. However, what I do know is that in tradition we have free will. And from the Jewish perspective, what happened in the Garden of Eden was necessary. If we're created so that we have the spark of holiness within us, if we're created B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, and then that says something about our that we already have a relationship with God. And when you have a relationship, there is the potential for a partnership. If we're alone, if we're isolated, what does that mean for our own capacity, our own growth? But if we're in partnership with anything, another person or the divine, that means that there's so much potential for growth. However, can we be partners without being able to make decisions? I mean, they ate of the fruit of knowledge and they realized that they had the capacity.
After the tree was planted.
Yes.
Yeah.
They realized they had the capacity
to
make good choices or bad choices. But in any relationship, we need that. I mean, are we going to be slaves to the relationship? Or are we going to be partners?
Right, right. But now, and then again,
where I'm heading is that situations get put in front of us whether we want it or not. And then we have to make choices. All the time we're making choices, so maybe there's an analogy there. I mean, life presents us with crap a lot of the time.
Yes.
With some things that seem arbitrary. And then how do we respond to it is what really makes us human.
Correct.
Being fully human and by really working to make choices, we are immolating God. I'm not answering your question exactly.
No, but yes,
but,
you are.
Voice from the heavens saying, take your son, that's a pretty arbitrary thing. I mean, in a way, that happens every day for each of us, possibly. That's my effort to answer. You have
it's,
some.
Yeah, it's important to look at the first verse. The first verse says, God tested Abraham.
Yeah,
that's where it starts.
Yeah,
and so we talked about that on Monday, and then also someone brought up, why didn't Abraham stick up for Isaac like he did for the in Sodom and Gomorrah, for the innocents in Sodom and Gomorrah, where he argued with
right,
God.
Right.
Well, what if there's 10?
Right.
What if there's 50?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, and he could have argued for his son. Now, my son is innocent. This is wrong.
Right. That I would have preferred, but still I don't like that God would call for I guess it's maybe because I really appreciated, who was the, what's her name? The rabbi that spoke last night?
Yohanna.
That's Yohanna.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that. This is not a story about children dying. I mean, that was the preface of her whole stuff. This is not a story, but that's not how the story in the text is. The text says, I want that kid dead. Now, of course, she knows the end of the story and knows the child's not going to die. But I wrestle with this God who says...
Well, you're doing exactly... If you ever get a chance, look for a book by Rabbi Arthur Waskow. He wrote it a long time ago, and it had a lot of influence in the progressive Jewish community. It's called God Wrestling.
Okay.
But God Wrestling, Torah Wrestling, this is why, you know, that the process in the first place is one of the reasons why we still have these works. And in the Jewish community, certainly in the, I guess, liberal/progressive Jewish community, we really emphasize process. That this is a sacred process.
Mm-mm-mm. The wrestling.
And also, I think about a couple other scriptural references. You know, I think I heard it somewhere here during the time I've been here about the reference to this is not something that's out there. It's right in your heart. So the out there is, in a sense, again, the test and you know, the command. And then in our heart, you know this in your heart. You already know what to do. So do it already. And then, you know, there's so many references because I've set before you the blessing or the curse, and the choice is yours.
Yeah. Death or life.
Does God any other time in the Old Testament ask for death of a child? I'm trying to go through. I can't think of any other time.
But there's...
It's enacted in 1 Kings by
yes,
David killing his grandchildren, killing seven.
But does it say that God
asked... And then, of course,
asked...
there's the Passover story where the firstborn died, Egyptian firstborn died.
Yeah, so there's, that's right. There's,
But these contexts are different.
Correct, right. And did the religions of that place and that time of Abraham require death of children?
Yes.
There's the whole, the altar of Moloch.
Right, right.
And so, you know, very clearly, this is the end of the notion of child sacrifice.
That's, yes.
And then in history, B, when the temple is destroyed, that is the end of animal sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And prayer, which in Hebrew is called avodah, that's one of the words. Worship is avodah, which means also means work. Like when you go to your job, mm-hmm. you do avodah. And when you pray, you do avodah. Mm-hmm. Prayer replaces sacrifice.
Worship is work.
Yeah, it is. Adam spoke last night about, about this a version of the Muslim story of Abraham, Ishmael, and here is another one of them, which addresses the whole issue of it being a trial, a test. And there is a Iranian work of art showing this. Look, the angel is swooping down, carrying the ram.
Yeah. That's how the ram got caught in the thicket, right? Dropped off by an angel.
And, you know, we started late, and I don't want to keep you unless you're willing to, you know, can you do 10 more minutes or do you need to go? The second half is looking at art and making art. Basically.
You mean this afternoon?
There's two more modern things here. One from the period of the First World War and one from quote rabbi unquote Leonard Cohen. who And these are both hard ones. These deal with modern realities of conflict and such. And the parable of the old man and the young was written by Wilfred Owen, who I think died in the First World War, or was one of the few survivors of a certain class of artistic young men from the United Kingdom. Lois, can you read the first the left side, and Bob, you can read the right side.
So Abram rose and clave the wood and went, and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they sojourned both of them together, Isaac, the firstborn, spake and said, "My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron. But where is the lamb for this burnt offering?" Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps, and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth the knife to slay his son.
When lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, "Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him. Behold a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Offer the ram of pride instead of him." But the old man would not so, so slew his son and half the seed of Europe one by one. Oh, well, that was, didn't see that coming at all.
That's heavy.
That is actually powerful. As I look at the poem again, I think Owen was one of the few survivors. There was a whole flourishing artistic and literary society in England before, at the start of the First World War, and it was devastated. And actually, Siegfried Sassoon was one of them, and a variety of other people. And I think Owen was one of the survivors.
Well, and also in England too, when during World War I, whole villages and areas of the countryside were all one unit. And yeah. So when those men were slaughtered, nobody came back to work the land, and it was devastating. And in fact, I forget there was one unit that does not, it has some way an altered relationship ritually with regard to the queen because of this. And so they do not do some ritual formality like kneel or bow or something like that that signifies this reality.
Now, when you think about so many modern issues, you know, do away with the ram of pride. Here, of course, he's kind of reversing the role of the ram. The ram is a substitute for the arrogance and pride of the father. As compared to the depiction of the ram as compassion, yeah. And you know, and life, and you know, another depiction of the ram. But here, do away with that. But the old man can't listen. And I think about so many issues now about the state of the world, where this poem is very appropriate. And then there's Leonard Cohen, and. What we can finish with this section, with this song. And why don't we just continue reading section by section.
The door is opened slowly. My father, he came in, was 9 years old, and he stood so tall above me. His blue eyes, they were shining, and his voice was very cold. He said, "I've had a vision. And you know I'm strong and holy. I must do what I've been told." So he started up the mountain. I was running. He was walking. And his axe was made of gold.
Well, the trees, they got much smaller. The lake, it lit as mirror. We stopped to drink some wine. Then he threw the bottle over. It broke a minute later, and he put his hand on mine. Thought I saw an eagle, but it might have been a vulture. I never could decide. Then my father built an altar. He looked once behind his shoulder. He knew I would not hide.
You who build these altars now to sacrifice these children, you must not do it anymore. A scheme is not a vision, and you never have been tempted by a demon or a god.
And I'm not, I think that there was a modification made. We can continue reading.
Okay.
I'm not, I think I scrambled exactly where this should be.
You who stand above them now, your hatchets blunt and bloody. You were not there before, when I lay upon a mountain and my father's hand was trembling with the beauty of the word.
And if you call me brother now, forgive me if I inquire just according to whose plan. When it all comes down to dust, I will kill you if I must. I will help you if I can. When it all comes down to dust, I will help you if I must. I will kill you if I can. And mercy on our uniform, man of peace or man of war, the peacock spreads his fan.
So I realized that I'm ending this part with heavy stuff about the nature of faith. That, you know, we talked about the dangers of faith and the blessings of faith. In many ways, it feels to me like our commentary about the ram is the counterbalance to what Owen and Leonard Cohen are writing. And we've talked a lot about the choices available for us and how our perception of choice is so critical. And in the second part, we're going to look more at what some artists have done with this, how some artists have seen this. And then if you're here, I'm going to ask you to be rather arbitrary. We're going to do art with torn paper and glue. And I'm going to provide you with about 5 ingredients in relationship to one another. And it sounds really simple, but it can be very, very effective. And then we will come together and have what artists call a critique, where we have a chance to talk about the art and answer questions and share with one another. So that's what happens in the second half.